is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us a very, very special guest this evening. In fact, it was on our afternoon program when one of our callers called in and said, you know, I was just rereading a book I read back and written in 1962 called None Dare Call It Treason. And that book is just as true today as it was when it was written. I said, I think that was written in 1964, as I recall, and was written by a man named John Stormer. In fact, we're going to have him as a guest on our program very, very soon. And I'd forgotten that we're going to have John Stormer on tonight. John, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always good to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, you know, I thought that maybe we'd do a couple of programs and just talk about history, because the problem is people don't understand history. If they don't understand how we got to where we are, they certainly can't understand where we are today and where we're going from here. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you happened to write that book? Was it 1964?
The book was published in February of 64, that's correct.
All right, fine.
I actually started, in January of 1961. I had a background as a liberal, thought I was a liberal until I heard a fellow named Barry Goldwater in August of 1960, and was astounded that he enunciated the principles and values I tried to apply in my business and personal life, only he said they'd work for government, like you can't spend more than you take in and some things like that. And I got his book, Conscience of a Conservative, and about 3 weeks later he came to St. Louis, and he was here, and I followed him around for 2 days. That got me going real strong and real good, and I started reading a lot of things. And then in January of 61.
Hold that thought there for just a minute here, and we'll be back in just a moment. Our guest this evening is John Stormer. His book, None Dare Call It Treason, sold about 7 million copies initially. I'm going to let him tell you the story. Well, John, you were saying it was 1961, and what happened?
I went into the library, and somebody had left a little newsletter on a table there called Human Events, and they said that they were going to be having a political action conference in Washington in January. And the thing that really attracted me, well, it was a nonpartisan conference. The two principal speakers were Barry Goldwater and Strom Thurmond, who at the time was a Democrat. But the thing that really attracted me, they were going to feature 4 young conservatives who had been elected to Congress in November of 60 on solid conservative platforms from Democrat districts. Well, I was a young conservative living in a Democrat district, and I thought, I'm going to go and find out how to do it. And I went up to Washington there, and on the second night, I called my wife, and I said, I'm the most respectable-looking and talking bunch of crackpots, or we're in real bad trouble. people from the platform, people like Fulton Lewis Jr., the old radio commentator, Willard Edwards, the Chicago Tribune columnist, some of the Congress people there were telling us that the National Council of Churches had communist influences in it, and the National Education Association. And I remember one instance, Walter Judd, the congressman from Minnesota, he'd been a medical missionary in China, and through that became concerned about the threat of communism, came home, ran for Congress. And he was speaking on the threats of communism. And when it got to question sessions, there was a lady from North Carolina, a dear lady. Her husband was a doctor down there. And she said, now, Dr. Judd, in 1956, the Secretary of the Army, Willard Brucker, testified before Congress that the communications lines in and out of the Pentagon were serviced by a union that was so heavily dominated by the communists that it was kicked out of the CIO. And he said, yes, ma'am, that's correct. And she said, well, what's been done about it? He said, nothing, that union is still there. And she said, well, in the name of God, hasn't something been done? And Dr. Judd said, well, those of us who are here who know that these problems exist, we can look at what has happened to everyone who's ever tried to make a difference, starting with Dyes, the congressman from Texas, and Harold Velde, the congressman from Illinois, and, of course, Joe McCarthy and others. And he said they get destroyed.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is John Storman. He's telling about he attended a meeting back in 1961 or so. I went to Washington, D.C., and there was a lot of the congressmen, Fulton Lewis Jr., a couple of congressmen, Walter Judge was a congressman, and he was saying that anybody who'd really tried to make a difference or oppose the communist influence at the highest levels of our government, whether it be Martin Dyes or Joe McCarthy or other congressmen, who tried to protect America from the communist and subversive influence had actually been destroyed. So you're sitting there in the audience, John, you're listening to this congressman, you're looking around the audience, you see a lot of real responsible people, and they're all concerned about the influence of communism in the United States. It's 1961, so what happened at that time?
Well, Dr. Judd said, those of us that know what's going on, we've decided that we're not gonna get our necks out until you people go home and send some more informed people up here that would back us up. And, well, as I said, I called my wife and said, I'm the most respectable looking talking bunch of crackpots, or we're be in bad trouble. So I came home from that, and in 3 months' time, I read about 40 books and thousands of pages of the hearings on why we lost China and the other things back there, and when we still had congressional investigating committees. And I came to see those crackpots only knew about half the story.
And really, of course, if we go back and we saw what happened as far as China is concerned, it's very obvious that the reason China went communist in 1949 was because the American State Department had refused to carry out the congressional dictates to ship weapons to Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek couldn't get weapons anywhere in the world. There wasn't a war going on. It was just a massive retreat, mostly for the part of the nationalist Chinese, because we'd put an arms embargo on them, and we brought communism to China. But the average American knew something was wrong, but they didn't really understand that the State Department seemed to have an entirely different agenda from the rest of the country. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct. And as I started to do my research and started then, I figured most people wouldn't read 40 books and thousands of pages of stuff. I thought maybe I could write a pamphlet that would sum it up, and it grew into, none dare call it treason, but in the process, just in line with what you said, I came to see that every communist country in the world had a Made in the USA stamp on it.
In other words, we had helped to bring the communist dictator to power.
That's right. Cuba particularly, there was a man with a name and a face in the State Department. His name was William Arthur Wayland, and he had worked on the fringes of some radical organizations, communist organizations in Colombia and Venezuela. He had known Castro, and he came to the place. He was a homosexual, or was reputed to be. He was a disciple of Sumner Wells, who was Under Secretary of State under Roosevelt back in the early 40s, and he brought a bunch of his proteges in, and Wayland became the head of the Caribbean desk in the State Department. And as the investigations were done later, they determined that he had received information from all sorts of people, military people and others, through Central South America, that Castro was a communist. But he buried all that stuff, and it was never passed along. And, course, Castro came to power. He was, the New York Times made him the George Washington of Cuba. And it was about 1961 before finally somebody said, oops, Whitey, we made a mistake.
And we brought, what I think the average American really doesn't understand, is that we brought Fidel Castro to power in Cuba, and there were people in our government, one of them, of course, was the American ambassador to Cuba at that time, Earl Smith, who I personally interviewed, of course, he said, of course we knew Fidel Castro was in power. Of course we knew we would bring him to power when we forced Batista to leave Cuba the following day, the day after I was instructed to tell Batista to leave, and of course we knew we were turning it over to the communists. But the average American was never allowed to realize that. They were always confused with all these phony stories. And so you were quite aware of this, and this was, of course, 1961, as you began reading and studying and,
right.
and
writing
all this information together.
It took 2.5 years to pull it all together. I finished my masterpiece, and I had been making my living writing for 15 years. I was a magazine editor. I'd edited an Air Force newspaper. I was an Air Force historian. I was a good writer, a good editor. But I finished my masterpiece, 2.5 years, and gave it to my good wife to read. And then I spent 9 months rewriting it. She was a tough editor. She was cruel and mean, but it sure improved the book.
Right. Well, the two of you together did a great job. And so, anyway, of course, then, did you ever try to get any major publisher to take it, or did you just decide to put that out on your own?
No, because, number one, except for... there was a little outfit called Regnery that has gone a little further now.
There was one, Devin Adair. Was it
Devin Adair. Right. I just lost that name for a minute. But they'd publish conservative books, and maybe if they had a real bestseller, it might sell 3,000 copies. And the thing that really converted me, though, I'd been in the publishing business, magazines, so forth, and was familiar with printing. And when I was awakening, and maybe I bought 100 copies of Conscience of a Conservative. I think it had a cover price of 75 cents. You'd buy 100 of them, and you'd still pay 40 cents for it. Fred Schwartz's book the same way. And I came to know the publishing business. And it continues today. A book distributor, one of the paperback distributors, will place an order for a couple of thousand books, and if they're a left-wing outfit, they get the books in, they sit in their warehouse for a year, they tear all the covers off, send the covers back, get all their money back.
Sure.
There has to be some real margin in there. So I decided that if we could bypass all those middle people, besides which I wanted to keep control of the book, and so for 2.5 years, as I was active in conservative activities, and I became the state chairman of the Young Republicans and on the Republican State Committee and other activities, I started to collect names of activists around the country. And in the 3 years, I collected about 125 names, mostly individuals, and then a few organizations. And when I got the book done, we mimeographed the manuscript, and I sent it out with individually typed letters. There were no computers in those days, tailoring the letter to what I knew the interests of the different people. And I said, now here's what we're trying to do, and if we can get enough books, enough of advanced sales, so we can print 100,000 copies, we can get the price down so you could buy 1,000 of them for $180 or 100 books for $25. I told them, you know, I'm not asking for handouts. It's just if you think you can use it. Well, we sent those letters out, and 87 of those 125 people placed orders for 55,000 books. And I knew that we kind of had something going. And with the money for the 55,000, we were able to print the first 100,000. And then I was the first person to put the coupon in the back of the book so people could order it direct and get those quantity prices if they bought in quantity. And within 2 weeks after the first 55,000 were shipped, the other 45,000 sold from people that had read it, and we took that money and ordered the next 100,000, and before they were ever delivered, they were all gone, they were sold, and we never got within 3 weeks of handling orders. We finally get up, so we print 400,000, 800,000, finally a million copies at a time, and it just went from there. Some of the people that got it early, there was a movie actor out in California. His name was Ronald Reagan, and he bought some books in quantity. And I wished later that I went back to the bank and asked them if they still had a microfilm of the check, but it had been destroyed a little bit before that. I didn't get around to do it until sometime middle 80s when he was president.
Well, anyway, of course, you actually got about 5 million copies totally ignored. Here's a book, 5 million copies gone out, not a word in the media, and then what happened?
Well, there was a total blackout. There was one TV commentator down in Raleigh, North Carolina, a fellow named Jesse Helms, who wrote a review on it. The Manchester Leader, Bill Loeb, he had an editorial on it.
That was Manchester.
Manchester, New Hampshire. And the New York Daily News, which at that point was still a fairly conservative newspaper, ran a lead editorial saying, this is going to be a controversial book, but it's worth checking out all the documentation.
And it was really talking about the communist influence in America, but it also talked about an organization which most Americans had never heard of at that time, and that was known as the Council on Foreign Relations, which seemed to be using communism as a foil so that we could rally the people behind our leaders in this country against this enemy overseas that we had financed and encouraged and helped at every stage from its inception. Well,
exactly.
This is the story of None Dare Call It Treason, written in 1964, and our author is John Stormer. Now, we have the update on that, None Dare Call It Treason, 25 years later. We still have the original, but, of course, if you're going to get it for the first time, why I suggest you get the None Dare Call It Treason 25 years later. But we'll be back in just a moment with Mr. Stormer to talk more about this incredible, incredible part of history that most people have forgotten. But you see, those who do not remember history are condemned to repeat it. Well, our guest this evening, John Stormer, and we're talking about that part of history where we felt that our real enemy was the world communist movement. And I remember that opening phrase I think you were talking about, was it a quarter of the world's population or quarter of the world's population and a third of the world's landmass were under communist control, or do I have it backwards?
Something like that.
Well, anyway, it was one way or the other, you know. It was they had, I think, a third of the world's landmass and a quarter of the population.
Right.
Anyway, go ahead. So, basically, of course, you're getting the conspiracy of silence. You've got 5 million copies of this book out. Everybody's reading it. Everybody's talking about it. At least the conservatives are. Of course, the liberals don't understand this. Of course, if it's been put out by a conservative, it's got to be bad because liberals don't like conservatives and conservatives don't like liberals. And the people at that time really didn't understand how they were really playing both sides against the middle, because lots of people who are liberals are just really very concerned about big government and taking away our freedom. But they think that if we give enough power to government, that they then can restrict the power of the wicked elite, the wicked capitalists, and that we can have freedom if we restrict their power, without realizing that in many instances it's the wicked capitalists that are pushing socialism. But pick up the story from there, John. Then what happened?
Well, as you indicated, between February and the end of August, we had over 5 million books in print. Not only in print, but being out there distributed. People buying, some people buy 100, some people buy 1,000. we'd get calls about 2 o'clock in the morning from California. A group of conservatives had gotten together and pooled their money, and they'd call me on my home phone here, which was the only phone I had in those days. We did all this out of our home, and they'd want to know how they could get some books. Now, I didn't mind those 2 o'clock calls when people wanted to buy 1,000 books. But about 6 o'clock in the morning, we'd start to get calls from Maine or New Jersey saying, where are those books I ordered 2 weeks ago? And the whole thing was done by individuals. And then we came into the first, about the 10th of September, and somebody sent me a little report turned out by a group up in Cleveland, a nonpartisan committee, of course, but the vice chairman of the Democrat Party was on it, and they met in a Unitarian church where Gus Hall, the head of the Communist Party, had spoken. And the report they turned out, supposedly questioning the documentation and so forth, was so poorly done, I just couldn't take it seriously. I thought it was some sort of a thrust, maybe, to see what sort of reaction I'd have. But about 10 days after that, the Christian Science Monitor ran a big story based on this National Committee for Civic Responsibility, and within about a week, the name Stormer was in headlines all across America, along with deceit and fraud, cheater, and all that kind of stuff.
Obviously, you were being effective, because they wouldn't have attacked you if you hadn't been. But what's so interesting is that the media would only show the one side. They would never show the other side. They would never say what was good about the book, only what was bad. The old idea, if you don't like the message, you attack the messenger.
That's right. And then people started to pick it up. Kogo TV down in San Diego, and we'd had multiplied thousands of books out in San Diego.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, John Stormer is telling his story of how he got the book out, about 5 million copies, and then about August of 1964, they form a committee somewhere, and it's a committee for a civic responsibility or something of the sort. Sounds very good. And of course, it's a meeting at a Unitarian church, and one of the heads of the local Democratic Party is on this, and they come up with a report condemning John's book and all the fraudulent information in that book. And pretty soon, why, this report is picked up by the Christian Science Monitor and the media all across America, and they're attacking John. Now, he's got 5 million copies of his book out, and he's done this all out of his garage and out of his living room, and he's put out this book that is having a profound impact on America. I know, because I read the book at that time. I bought 1,000 copies, and we put them out. We were handing them out like candy, and at least some of them were getting read, and some people, a small group of people, were beginning to understand we had a real problem in America. And it was at that point that the so-called conservative movement that Barry Goldwater led at that time began to be born. And that book and another book by Phyllis Schlafly called A Choice, Not an Echo, really began to have an impact, but it was, none dare call it treason, that really swept this country with a well-documented expose, not only of the communist influence, but the fact that there was this other organization, this elitist organization known as the Council on Foreign Relations, working within the shadows, that seemed to be directing and controlling our State Department and advancing the cause of communism throughout the world, which at that time none of us understood, but we just knew something was seriously wrong. And now John Stormer is under vicious attack. So pick up the story from there. Now the Christian Science Monitor has written articles condemning you, and what was the background of that article?
Well, they basically picked out, I think, 10, the book, I think, had 890-some references, footnotes, documentation, and they picked out, I think, 10 of them, and said that they were just total frauds and so forth, and in some cases they denied. In some cases, I took a liberal, some liberal writer's thing, and used it to document a fact. Now, they maybe were approving. For example, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was in John Kennedy's administration, a longtime historian, and he wrote a 3 or 4 page article in, I don't know whether it was in The Nation or one of those publications, on the way to achieve socialism in America. And we referenced that, and they went through that and picked out some little line in there where Schlesinger raised some question about the danger of socialism or something, but we need to overlook that danger. And they just said it was fraud. In some cases, we had a reference to a congressional record, and our reference had to do with the CIO kicking out some communist unions in the late 30s and early 40s. And it was something they were very proud of. And we used that. But the article in the Congressional Record started on like page 42, and the actual statement then was on page 43 on the continuation. And they'd say, there's absolutely nothing on page 42 that refers to anything like this. as I say, it was just, it was a farce, and, but it was picked up, and, there was one Christian Science fellow up in Michigan who distributed a lot of books, and he went out and got the original documentation out of the libraries and duplicated it all and sent it up to, Erwin Cannon, who was the editor of the Monitor at the time.
And also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Right,
that.
Right.
He was part of the problem, but nobody's going to tell anybody that this guy was the editor of the Christian Science Monitor that was attacking John Stormer, came from the very organization that John Stormer was exposing.
Well, that's right, and he wrote a letter back, I got a copy of it here somewhere, in which he said, well, When our reporter went to the library to check out this reference, the book was out, this and that, but we're not going to make any correction because it's still a bad book.
Right, and of course the thing is that whenever you tell the truth, and unfortunately the media is controlled, so many of the, now of course in those days, the television networks were not this force that they are today, the television, the radio, and there are about 6 corporations that control the media here in the United States, they effectively control what the American people think. And of course, but back in those days, the same control was there, perhaps not quite as well centralized, but still the control was there. And the American people were, only a few of them, were ever heard anything good about the book, and yet it sold how many copies, John?
Well, it sold 7 million, 6 million in 64.
We'll be right back in there in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we're talking with John Stormer, whose book sold 7 million copies. And really, this is a phenomenal book. I mean, there are not very many books that have 7 million copies out. I doubt they'll get that many copies of Bill Clinton's autobiography in circulation. But nonetheless, why it had a tremendous impact. Was it ever really reviewed favorably by any of the major media other than those you've already mentioned?
No, the only other one, I think the Indianapolis Star, Stan Evans, was a young 23 or 24 year old editor there, and after the election he wrote a very good review on it. Of course Stan has gone on to be a real factor in as an author and so forth in the years since.
Alright.
You mentioned the CFR. George Romney was the governor of Michigan at the time, and somebody asked him about the book, and he said, and in fact he wrote a letter, and said, just to show you how fraudulent this book is, Stormer says that I'm a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I am not, never have been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, the interesting thing was, I didn't think Romney was important enough, I didn't even mention his name in the book.
So, you know, of course, the thing is that by making that charge, why he tends to discredit you, and of course, you can say, of course, I'm not a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, but how many people are going to read the book all the way through to find out that he's lying? But course, everything going on today is a lie. You are deceiving the people of America, are being systematically deceived on so many issues. And anybody who tries to bring out the truth is immediately attacked, or, as for instance the case of Michael Perutka with the Constitution Party, are going to be on the ballot in 41 or 42 states in America. I was told recently that Pat Buchanan was on the Chris Matthews show, and Chris Matthews was asking Pat Buchanan who he was going to vote for. He said, you're not going to vote for Bush, but you can't vote for Kerry. No. You're going to vote for Nader. No. Well, who are we going to vote for? Michael Perutka. And Chris Matthews' remark was, who's Michael Perutka?
Right.
And, Chris, here's one of the major opinion makers in America, who, of course, has never heard of the candidate for the Constitution Party. Why? Because he's a victim of the thought control, just like most of the other people within the media today. Well, John, of course, a lot of water has gone under the bridge since, and none dare call it treason, and yet that book is, I think, as valid today as it was when you wrote it back in almost 40 years ago.
I get calls, a couple of calls a month, probably, from people. Some of them, they pick up a copy of the old 256-page None Dare Call It Treason.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, I guess this evening is John Stormer, and we're talking about his book, None Dare Call It Treason. And believe me, this book is as apropos today as it was when it was written back in 1964. And, of course, it goes into really not only the communist threat, but this whole philosophy behind our form of government, and then the collectivists on the other side. And what's really so interesting is that there really are groups like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission. Those weren't very well known. In fact, the Trilateral Commission wasn't even formed at that time. But these organizations dedicated to socialism, headed by some of the richest and most powerful people in the world. And why would wealthy and powerful people want to be pushing socialism? Well, very, very simply, because it centralizes all power with government, and somebody's going to control the elected officials, and that's why in America today, in Washington, D.C., we have the finest politicians money could buy, because they're controlled by the very people that, of course, most of the liberals want to keep out of, from influencing the political system. John Kerry's wife has $1.5 billion, and he's running as the representative of the little man. And, of course, the Bush family has been around, has fabulous wealth and holdings as well. Certainly not like the Kerrys, but they certainly have done pretty well through their service to government. Go ahead, pick up the story there, John.
Well, the attacks, of course, continued, and the problems continued. We went into the Vietnam War, which we were required to, well, we won all the battles on the battlefield, but then we would lose it at the conference table, and we came along, and finally about, well, people would, I was just saying, people are calling me a few times a month. People say, I found this little book for 10 cents in a Salvation Army bookstore or Goodwill store, and are you still alive? Yes. And then we're able to tell them that we did bring out None Dare Call It Treason 25 years later, which has the original book in it without any change. History doesn't change. But about 400 pages of additional material on why we lost the Vietnam War. There's a chapter in there on why are our leaders betraying us, which is a very significant one. We look at maybe 7 different conspiratorial forces that I see working in the world. They're all working towards world government. They cooperate to some extent because they think that ultimately they'll be the ones that'll come out on top. There's the communists, there's the world banking interests, there's the intellectual socialists, the Fabians, there's the world homosexual movement that it's a worldwide movement, and it has infiltrated government in a very definite way. There's the conspiracy, or the coalition, if you would, of liberal religious forces, the National World Council of Churches crowd, the Vatican II Catholics, the Reformed Jews, and they're bringing together all the other ecumenical forces of the world. The world crime forces, of which the mafia is just one part. And then the biggest conspiracy, or the biggest problem as I see it, is what I would call the conspiracy of shared values. Anybody that's gone to college in the last almost 60 years, well, I was at Penn State in the years following World War II, and 15 years later, when I started to study Marxism and started to study dialectical materialism, I had to come to realize that I had been taught all the basic fundamentals of Marxism at Penn State in the years right after World War II. And that has permeated our society, so these knowing conspirators are able to manipulate the thinking of people who have bought so many of the, well, we were the children of the Depression, and our economics class taught us that the Depression showed that capitalism has failed, and some measure of control over economics needs to be necessary. And in psychology, we were taught that man's a total product of his environment, and the environment will change. Well, that's straight out of Marxism. That you get into philosophy and other places, there are no absolutes; all things are relative. And even my history class. Now, I was an engineer, and engineers had to take one history class, and the history was the economic history of America, taught totally from an economic determinism viewpoint. And so that has permeated our society so that the knowing conspirators can come in and manipulate these people and move these people to go the direction they go.
Well, now, why is it that our leaders, these people of great wealth, are pushing these philosophies which will ultimately destroy this country and the free enterprise system that has allowed these people of great wealth to amass their fortunes?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think there's a couple of maybe answers. I think some of those people, maybe through the education, for example, the Rockefellers were all got their primary schooling under the direct tutelage of John Dewey at Columbia. And in the process of training these people, they put a guilt trip on them for the money they have. That's number one. Secondly, I think that some of them get the vision that they can, through their use of money, get control of the world and use that control to solve all the world's problems, and, you know, through idealism and so forth. Then there are some people that are just power hungry and see that they, if they submit themselves to the Bilderbergers or these other groups, that we can get ahead. The CFR, they have influenced major companies, so young rising executives get sent to training seminars conducted by the CFR to prepare these men to be able to function in the coming New World Order. So there's all sorts of reasons. Of course, the communists are there, and they're being used, but they think that if the New World Order comes, that they'll be able to control it because they're the ruthless ones. The intellectual socialists think they're smarter than the rest, the bankers, because we control the money, and we'll finally bring them down. And there's all these factors involved.
All right, fine. Do you think some of them are just plain evil? Is there a spiritual component to what we're seeing?
Well, in that chapter on why are our leaders betraying us, we do indicate that all of these conspiracies are ultimately under the control of Satan, the master conspirator.
And I really think that is what the message I hope many of our listeners will remember, that all of these conspiracies are ultimately under the control of Satan, the master conspirator. I think that is a beautiful statement, and I think it's so accurate. And until we recognize there's a spiritual component to everything that's going on, then we're going to continue to be confused and wonder why these people are doing things that just don't make sense. And they may actually be led into doing things that don't make sense by forces that they perhaps even themselves don't understand.
That's right. And, well, you looked at Ephesians chapter 2. It says that we who were once dead in trespasses and sins, and in that point we were controlled and manipulated by Satan through appealing to our lusts and our desires of our mind and our bodies and so forth. And so anybody that's not a Christian, anybody that hasn't put their faith in Jesus Christ, that he died not just for the sins of the world, but that he died for their individual personal sins, and they put their trust in him, and the risen Christ comes into their heart and makes a new person out of them, until you can come to that place, then you're just a tool of Satan. No matter how much you may try to do good or whatever, you're part of that system.
Well, I'd like to get your view on Vietnam. What was Vietnam all about? Because we certainly didn't go over there, as I thought initially, to defeat communism. So what was Vietnam really about, in your estimation?
Well, I think there could be books written if there were conspirators, and there were. Some of the people, maybe CIA, others, they saw that there were some communists up north there, and in place after place around the world, the answer of our State Department and the CIA and some of those forces to communism anywhere, or to bad people, the Batistas and some of them, was we're going to have to go to work to replace them with some form of benevolent socialism. And they replaced the anti-communist government in South Vietnam with some of these socialists who weren't really able to stand up. Much the same thing happened. Syngman Rhee, when Korea was divided at the end of World War II, setting up a place where there was going to be all sorts of tensions. Syngman Rhee was a Christian, and he established there a rather solid government, but they went to work and brought him down with the same sort of attacks that any Christian that stands up, Chiang Kai-shek, and whether or not they were knowingly installing communists that, or, you know, the Chinese were agrarian reformers, they never recognize a communist until they're too late, and then they say, oops, we made a mistake. And the only reason why they were able to succeed was because of these bad free enterprisers and these bad people that believed in freedom and Christianity and so forth. There could be some who would feel, and there could be maybe a basis that getting us involved in that quagmire certainly alienated a whole generation of young Americans, helped to radicalize them, and that radical generation that was produced by the disciples of John Dewey in their previous 30 years control of education, today those radicals, some of whom went off to Canada or Oxford or someplace to avoid serving, today they control our basically our culture shaping institutions.
In fact, one of them is running for the presidency of the United States.
Right.
Let's go to Daniel, who's calling from Almond. Is that Wisconsin?
Yes, that's Almond, Wisconsin. Oh. Central Wisconsin.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment? Are you listening shortwave or internet?
Internet, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
First, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Stan. I'm just recently aware of your materials, and they're just absolutely wonderful. And you're a real treasure and just a storehouse of great information.
Well, I've got the other great storehouse of information with me tonight, John Stormer, who's certainly was one of my mentors in this.
Well, I'm a man. I'm in my early 30s. And I have an interest, of course, in politics and in the country. And like so many people my age, I want to be a conservative and make a positive impact, and I'm just completely disenfranchised with the current state of the Republican Party. And I was wondering, what are your thoughts about Pat Buchanan, and are there any political parties that you feel comfortable with at this time?
Well, let me ask John Stormer that question. John, how would you answer Daniel, who says he feels disenfranchised? He thinks the Republican Party is not doing too good a job, and he wants to know about what about Pat Buchanan or other political parties?
Well, you mentioned earlier that Pat Buchanan on the Chris Matthews show indicated that he was going to be voting for Michael Peruca of the Constitution Party this year. And I think the to me a tragedy is that in 1996 Pat had tried to run for president in 92. In 96 he had made some impacts, but they weren't going to let him be the presidential candidate. And the Taxpayer Party, the predecessor of the Constitution Party, had invited Pat, had enticed Pat, we had encouraged Pat, and in fact a lot of the people that worked to get that party a ballot position were sure that Pat Buchanan would, when it became obvious that where the Republicans were going, that he'd come over and be the candidate on that party. And had he done so then, I think there was a momentum going, and in a three-way race, well, it was actually a four-way race because Perot was in that year too. In a four-way race, somebody that got 30 or 35% of the vote might capture the electoral college, and I think Pat might have had a real chance to be elected that year. Howard Phillips, the founder and the then presidential candidate, would have stepped aside for Pat. But Pat continued then, and I've known Pat Buchanan. He got his start as an editorial writer here in the St. Louis Globe Democrat in the early 1960s, and as Pat sometimes says, we used to chase the commies around Missouri together. He took a long time to make the break, and I think he waited too long. But he's supporting, and there's this effort made to give an opportunity to express your disillusionment and support somebody who I think if you go and take a look at the Constitution Party platform and the pledges of the people who are involved, I think you find you agree just down the line.
And I think Michael Peruca is a fine Christian gentleman. I believe he believes just as you and I do, Daniel. So why don't you go up to their website, Constitution Party, go to Google, and you can either get the link to Michael's website or the Constitution Party website. We do have an alternative. We just need to let everybody know there's an alternative. It's amazing how you can conceal the truth when you control the media.
Thank you very much, and God bless both of you.
Thanks so much, Daniel. And we'll just be back with Ken in just a moment here. He's from Post Falls, Idaho, and we'll take his note during his call during the last break, and then we'll have to let John go. Hang on there for just a minute, John. And hi, Ken. How are you doing?
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
My name's Ken, and I just want to tell John hi. I was in the airport with him. He probably doesn't remember me, but we were in a wedding party.
I can't hear what he's saying.
All right, fine. I'll tell you in just a moment.
Okay.
We get back. Hey, thanks very much for calling, Ken.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and that was Ken calling from Post Falls, Montana. He said that he had known you when you were in the Air Force together. You were in a wedding party together. You know, that's a long, long time ago. You may not remember a wedding party with a fellow named Ken, who probably at that time didn't live in Post Falls, Montana, but Post Falls, Idaho. But he just said he wanted to give you his best regards.
Well, I wish that he'd dropped me a note at Box 32 in Florissant, Missouri. 6302, and maybe we can renew an acquaintance.
All right, give that address just one more time.
John Stormer, Box 32, Florissant, Missouri, 63032.
Well, I just want to mention for our listeners that we do carry John's books, None Dare Call It Treason, None Dare Call It Treason 25 Years Later, None Dare Call It Education, and then three videos. One of them is, What Are the Dead Communists Doing Now? What are the other two videos that we carry of yours?
The War Against Our Culture Through the Schools, and then The Biblical Basis for the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Now, do you have a website people can go to?
No, I'm a one-man operator. I haven't had time to work one up.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, they can write to you, get your address. They could even subscribe to your newsletter, couldn't they?
Right. I'd send a sample copy to anybody that was interested.
And I get that. I always look forward to what John has at the month letter. The newsletter comes out, what, about every couple of months?
When significant news demands.
Well, it's always very, very insightful.
Most of the things I write are, I just write about things that nobody else is dealing with.
Well, I think that's important, and certainly John has a lifetime of knowledge and experience. He's lived through this whole thing, the same experiences we've all had, but he's always been there, known the movers and shakers. He became a minister, spent part of his life, all of his life in the ministry. He still teaches a Bible study to the legislators there in Missouri. What is it, every week that they're in session?
Weekly, then when they're in session, right.
And are you getting more legislators out there?
We ran during this last legislative session up to maybe 35 a week, and including a good part of the leadership of the legislature, and a couple of the people who used to be regular with us when they were in the Missouri legislature are now up in Congress and the Senate. So.
Well, I'm sure that will have an impact, and of course, anything you do is like dropping a pebble into a pond, and those ripples keep going out. John Stormer, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our interview with John Stormer, who's really an important part of history in his book, None Dare Call It Treason, one of the most important books ever written. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time I want to remind you we carry the original book, None Dare Call It Treason, and then we carry the updated book, None Dare Call It Treason, 25 years later, going into, of course, the Vietnam fiasco and so many of the things that have happened, and going into the background of these men who really do rule America and why these people do what they do. So there's another 400 pages in addition to the original book, which is there in its entirety, because as John says, history doesn't change. So then we have John Stormer's book, None Dare Call It Education. We have three videos he's produced. One has to do with what are the dead communists doing now? One deals with education. One deals with the background of our Constitution. You can get the individual videos, you can get them all together as a set. But John does a wonderful job of putting this information out in a very organized and a very communicative fashion. John is one of the great giants of our time, and I consider it a real privilege to have him as a guest here and to consider him a friend. So if you'd like to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-544-8927, and ask them about John's books or ask them about John's videos. And, of course, titles, one of them is, What Are the Dead Communists Doing Today? And then, of course, one has to do with the background of our educational system. One has to do with the foundation of our form of government, our Constitution, which was built upon the concept of limiting the power of government. And everybody, when we wrote that Constitution, knew America was going to be a Christian nation. Now, that didn't mean people from other countries couldn't live here, because we always wanted to be able to welcome people from other cultures. But once we lost the Christian foundation of this nation, we would lose this nation. Or as de Tocqueville said, America is good because America is great. America is great because America is good. But if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. And that's really what's happening today. The satanic forces are eroding the underpinnings of our society. How are they doing it? Well, one way through music. Of course, they have their people planted at every level of our government, in education, in the foundations, in the corporations, in government. But if you get the video, they sold their souls for rock and roll, either the 4 or the 10-hour version. You'll understand a great deal of the history of America, and you'll hear them singing about Aleister Crowley, Marilyn Manson, Ozzy Osbourne, and of course, Aleister Crowley was a Satanist, and you'll see his picture on the front of the album of the Beatles. They all understood what this was about. They just didn't want you to understand. This satanic movement, which has gripped the music, that of course energized the decades of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And now is in our churches. Yes, Satan's music is being, twanged out in our churches by the electric guitars and the beat, and it's the music itself. Don't ever believe if somebody tells you there's no such thing as Christian music, there are only Christian lyrics and that anything goes. This is Satan's music. It has the same beat as the drums of Africa that are used to bring in the demons. And they're doing that in both the Catholic and Protestant churches today, and many of them understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of mankind. Now, you can get all of the items we're talking about, or those videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll, 4 or 10 hours. They're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. We hope that many of you will, of course, like to get a free copy of our newsletter. We'll send you our latest newsletter. We hope many of you will want to come to our November 6th meeting here on the North Shore of Monterey Bay. All day long session with luncheon, bringing in outside speakers. I think it'll be a memorable day. That's November 6th. You're going to have to call though and make reservations. Our number 1-800-544-8927, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, because we don't turn back to God. Is there any reason God should ever bless this country again? And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be with you once again. Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the evening right now on the line Jerry Smith, and we're going to be talking about chemtrails. Are they real? Is this part of the imagination of the people who believe in black helicopters, or is there really something going on there? Hi, Jerry. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm doing good.
Why don't you tell us how you got interested in this subject of chemtrails?
Well, I was writing my last book I wrote was Heart, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, and I was working on the first draft of it summer of 1995, and to be perfectly honest, that was the first year that I was full-time writing for about a decade, and I was really enjoying the fact I didn't have a 9-to-5 job to go to, and so I partied a lot, and I spent most of that summer really too hungover to move, sitting in my garden, watching the grass grow around my lawn chair, thinking about how I ought to be back in the office writing the book. And as I'm lying there in my lawn chair looking up at the sky, I realize that's not right. What I was looking at in the sky, just I was seeing these contrails, these chemtrails that would linger for hours, for the whole day. It would you'd start off with a beautiful blue sky at 9 in the morning, and by 2 in the afternoon, the sky had turned as white as a sheet of paper.
All right. Well, of course, so couldn't that have just been sort of an accident? Couldn't that have been a climatic change? Or was there anything to make you suggest that this was a byproduct of a stratospheric spraying by a government, some sort of a government program?
Well, I was part of Jim Keith's circle. Jim Keith wrote the book on black helicopters, Black Helicopters Over America, Strike Force for the New World Order. And I was one of his researchers, and I did quite a bit of writing on the book. And we put together a circle of researchers and media watchers and paranoids. And that circle still meets every Saturday night at a Denny's in Sparks, Nevada. And even though Jim died in 1999.
A very mysterious circumstance, incidentally. I was an orthopedic surgeon, as you know.
Exactly.
And nobody ever died that I know of, or any of my friends ever, doctors who ever had a patient die after a arthroscopic knee surgery. But Jim died after this surgery. And then what was so amazing was his publisher died just within a couple of months. And then of course, his ex-wife died within a couple of months of that. Now, is that all coincidence? Well, Jim actually thought that they were going out to get him because of his exposés. Wasn't he aware of the fact, or didn't he believe that there would be the CIA would come after him?
Jim believed he was bulletproof. Jim was quite sure that whatever was going on in this realm wouldn't bother him much, and he was very spiritual and, you know, didn't really feel any big concerns about it.
Well, it was certainly a very, very strange situation. Apparently, he died of a massive pulmonary embolus. And then what happened to his publisher?
He died of a strange food poisoning that normally doesn't even upset one. It only makes one or two out of 100 people sick, and only kills like one out of 10,000.
And what about his wife?
Jim Keith's
ex-wife.
But they never actually got married.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment.
But she was murdered.
Well, this is a guest this evening is Jerry Smith, and Jim Keith had written a number of books put out by the Illuminati Press, and on, of course, on mind control and black helicopters, and we actually have many of those books. And they really were getting into the background of so many of these strange things that are going on today, that there really is an invisible force working behind the scenes in our society and manipulating us, controlling what we believe, what we think. But one of the most interesting aspects of this are the aerial spraying. So we pick up the story. You were sort of aware of the fact that something seriously was going on, or something strange was going on, and you were looking up there and you were saying, the sky just can't get looking quite like that. Something is happening, and it's not simply an atmospheric alteration. So pick up the story, Jerry.
Right. So the Jim Keith's circle was all abuzz with chemtrails, but we had noticed it. Members of the circle had noticed it about 94 or 95. And here, I live in Reno, Nevada. Jim also did. And we are in one of the most heavily chemtrailed parts of the country. I remember one Thanksgiving morning, when I still had a day job, I was standing out in front of the place where I work, and for about an hour, I watched the sky and counted 150 separate contrails in the sky over my head and watched them do it. And it wasn't just straight lines. It wasn't just tic-tac-toes. I mean, the one plane went in a big circle. It was pretty amazing sky that day, and that actually turned out to be fairly common. Before we went on the air here, I was talking with your radio switchboard guy, Kevin, and he commented that he'd gotten a call from one of the ladies in your church earlier today who asked, you know, we're not seeing many chemtrails right now. What's up with that? And so I explained to him that what it is right now we're in summer, and in summer you don't see them as much simply because a normal condensation trail requires at least 70% relative humidity in order for it to be formed. One of the ways to determine whether or not you're looking at a normal or an abnormal event is if the trail is being formed in air that has less than 70% humidity, you're looking at something different.
All right, fine. And but then, of course, is this a government project? Do you believe that the government is involved in some sort of a spraying program? And if so, why would they be doing that, and why would they be concealing it from the American people?
Well, it's not an easy question to answer, and I'm...
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Jerry Smith, and he's a writer. He's has been working for some years on this subject of what are chemtrails? Is this really a real phenomenon? Is this something that's a figment of the imagination? There are many, many people who believe that there is some sort of a government program, massive aerial spraying for a specific purpose that then will cloud the sky over, and you'll actually see the planes not flying from here to there, but flying back and forth across the sky, or as Jerry was describing, flying in a circle over and over again. And of course, behind them comes this cloud, and then this cloud covers eventually comes to cover the sky, and it's sort of it's not a nice white cloud. It's sort of an off white, and it doesn't look like a healthy situation. And of course, people all over the world are describing this phenomenon. And of course, in Reno, where Jerry lives, this is not an uncommon occurrence, and it usually doesn't happen as much in summer as in the fall and the winter. Would that be right?
That's correct.
Okay.
This involves a technology, a number of technologies that is the sort of thing that we were not taught in school. It's the sort of thing that, unless you are a particular type of advanced scientist in one of a number of different fields, this stuff makes no sense whatsoever and sounds completely strange and bizarre. If you do a Google search, I was just before we went on the air, I decided just for grins to do a Google search, and I put in the word chemtrails and got 82,500 hits. There's an awful lot of stuff on this on the internet, and for the person just starting to research this, it's absolutely overwhelming, the amount of information and disinformation and confusion and pointing of fingers and saying it's real, saying it's not real. So I want to let your listeners know that I have tried to sort this out for them. This actually is the subject of my next book, which is going to be Chemtrails, HAARP, and Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. And I have a website, jerryesmith.com, and on my website I have a page of ongoing research in which, as I find things that will eventually be referenced in the book, that will eventually be my bibliography, as I find them, I put them up on the website so that my readers can follow along. So I highly recommend that if anybody really wants to know more about this, go to my website, jerryesmith.com, and click on books, and then click on ongoing research. And that will take you to about 50 of the most important articles I've found on the subject.
And have you come across some of these government reports talking about how they want to use this to control global warming?
I have indeed. There's a fellow by the name of Edward Teller. You may be familiar with Dr. Teller.
Yes, we even interviewed him before he passed away.
Yes, he was He was the fellow who invented the hydrogen bomb. He was a very odd fellow. He was one of the world's great weapon builders, and he came up with and broadly publicized the idea of creating a shield in the upper atmosphere to reflect back the sun's solar rays as a way of reducing greenhouse heat, so as a way to fight global warming.
But, Chris, what's always bothered me, Jerry, is wouldn't we, in some respects, be trapping the heat from getting back and reflecting off the Earth by putting that shield up there?
Absolutely. I have links to two articles written by Teller in which he extols this, and I have links to five or six articles that examine this at some length. And responsible scientists have looked at Teller's plan and said, no, this won't work. This will actually trap more heat than it will reflect back.
But, of course, this was the idea. If we could simply create this shield, and, of course, it would have to be made of something perhaps metallic, like maybe aluminum and barium, and we could spray that. And, of course, this is really sort of almost like a Dr. Strange Glove type of a macabre experiment, isn't it, on the American public and really on the whole world to see if it'll work.
Right. I suspect that Teller was actually playing disinformation agent, that when he wrote this, there were already a number of projects, military covert projects, dumping aluminum and barium and strontium and a number of other very strange things into the atmosphere for a number of very very technical reasons. There's a website called Patently Obvious that lists hundreds of patents for aerosol programs for meddling with the atmosphere and the technologies specifically to do a variety of things. One of the things that was experimented with, one of the patents I have, is a patent from 1978. In which they inject barium into the atmosphere to create a bounce point to enhance direct radio communications from. I do know that there are a number of advanced radar systems that have come online, and these advanced radar systems use a variety of technologies to get over the horizon radar to be able to see way out there. And one of the things that these things need is to charge the atmosphere. And that charging the atmosphere means dumping barium or aluminum or so forth into the atmosphere.
But what is the effect of that aluminum that they're putting in the atmosphere on the human beings who would inhale that or get that, of course, into the food, alter the food chain and get more aluminum? Because we know there's a relationship between that and Alzheimer's disease.
Absolutely. There was an environmental impact study done at the end of the 70s for one of these aerosol programs out of University of Hawaii, and they concluded, well, this little test of this little bit of stuff in the air isn't going to have any effects, so don't worry about it. So I think what we got going on here is that any of the release, any of the declassified environmental impact studies, I'll say there's not a problem. This is one of the things with HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, is it had an environmental study that was complete nonsense.
But of course, if it was just one little study, but this is not. This is a massive worldwide program, and there are actually
a number of programs. This is the thing. It's not one program. There are dozens, maybe hundreds of different programs doing different things.
And they're spending billions of dollars on these aerial tankers dumping this stuff into our atmosphere. I mean, really polluting it. Where is the environmentalist when you need them?
Exactly.
They're actually polluting the stratosphere with this, and of course it will descend on down. And I've actually seen samples of this on trees. It almost looks like Christmas, things where you put the wreaths around the tree.
Right.
Except, of course, it's a very amorphous substance. And may even be bringing stratospheric organisms down, bacteria or viruses or something circulating up there that never were meant to come to Earth.
That's very possible. That's one of the polymerized versions, and there's a number of aspects of that. One of the things I've discovered is that you may recall what 20, 30 years ago there was a number of major oil spills, like the Exxon Valdez in the Gulf of Mexico, and they had developed this genetically engineered organism to eat the oil spill. And it had been very, very successful, and they had raved about it. We don't hear about this anymore. I guess we haven't had any big oil spills for a while. But this this organism is a variation. It's a man-altered, I won't say man-made, but a man-altered version of the strep virus.
Strep bacteria.
Yes, strep bacteria, exactly. And there are, 16 different members of the strep family, of which two have been very successfully modified, and one of them has been modified to eat oil, and apparently it is now a constituent in jet fuel, because they put it in as a fuel additive to eat the gunk out of the lines.
Well, the thing is that there are all sorts of government reports and books that actually talk about this aerial spraying project, but they don't want the people to know. They feel that we really are not intelligent to understand what the elitists are doing, and these are all being done in the name of science. But the question is, what are the long-term implications? Well, they're going to find out, and if people start dying, they'll say, "Oh, shucks, well, that was a terrible thing." We're seeing rising rates of cancer, of Alzheimer's disease, progressive neurological disease, and there are many, many reasons for it. But, of course, many of it tie into heavy metals. And
right.
Why would they be spraying heavy metals into the stratosphere that's going to come down into your yard and into the air you breathe?
Well, there are a couple of you know, the old thing is follow the money. Look at who makes a profit on this, and the kinds of profit that are being made, and the light bulbs start coming on. One thing is you may not know this, but there was the derivatives market. You know, the derivatives market that took down Orange County and took down Enron. Well, one of the derivatives was weather derivatives. A change of 1 degree on a summer day can mean the cooling industry, you know, the electrical suppliers that sell the electricity that runs the air conditioning, if the day is 1 degree cooler, they don't sell as much electricity that day, and they have and the weather derivatives field is now about $1.5 billion a year.
$1.5 billion or $1.5 trillion? $1.5 billion.
$1.5 billion a year, millions of dollars can change hands in a single day, over these derivative trading.
Well, of course, what was it that Warren Buffett said? You know, financial weapons of mass destruction, presently latent but potentially lethal. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Jerry Smith. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Jerry Smith. We're talking about chemtrails. Well, you are firmly convinced that these are something that's real, mainly because it's all up there on the Internet. It's all been documented. It's even documented in government publications, isn't it?
Yes. Getting the right publications are really difficult to come by. But you can get patents. And there are hundreds of patents on aerosol programs and aerosol technologies that could be or are being used in aerosol programs. And then, of course, there are a few government declassified papers, like the Air Force 2025 papers. The Secretary of the Air Force instructed the Air College to come up with what it would take for the United States to be the dominant air power in the year 2025. And there are 40-some papers in this series of position papers, and one of which is owning the weather. Weather as a force multiplier, owning the weather in 2025.
Can they actually create hurricanes today?
Officially, no. It looks like they may be able to steer hurricanes. They may be able to steer weather fronts. I've been following this at some length for the last year or so, working on this weather warfare book, and apparently, and I don't understand the technology of it, I just have a rudimentary grasp of it, but what's going on is that radar doesn't just show where the clouds are. Radar actually energizes the clouds and creates energy differentials between the air masses. And when you have a differential between two adjacent air masses, if you can jack up the difference, you can drag, you can pull, you can push air masses around. And the weather radars are not just showing us where the weather is, they're actually moving them around.
Well, now, what about HAARP? Or where does HAARP fit into this whole incredible story? Well, for our listeners out there, that's the High Altitude Auroral Research Project. And, of course, it is a program by which they heat the ionosphere. There are several of these, but the major one we talk about is up in Alaska. And, you know, they can put 1 billion watts of electricity up in the ionosphere, heat the ionosphere. Why would anybody want to heat the ionosphere and spend countless millions of dollars doing that unless they have some purpose in mind? Pick up the story there, Jerry.
Oh, boy. Okay, it's the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, which is a field of antennas on the ground in southeastern Alaska that are so linked together as to work as one giant antenna. When completed in 2006, it will be the world's largest radio broadcast station, but it's not designed to broadcast for human ears. As you put it, it's designed to inject energy into the top of the atmosphere, into the region known as the ionosphere. And when completed in 2006, it should be able to inject about 3.6 billion watts of effective radiated power. To give you an idea of what 3.6 billion watts is, in the U.S., the largest AM radio station is 50,000 watts. HAARP is 72,000 AM radio stations, injecting the entire energy of their output into a spot that's about 2.5 miles deep by about 12 miles across, and depending on where they're injecting it at, between 50 and 90 miles above Alaska. Now, the stated purpose of this is, one, characterization of the ionosphere, to just to inject energy and see what it does.
All right, we'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Jerry Smith, and we're talking about HAARP. And, of course, this is this means by which they inject this massive amounts of energy into the ionosphere. And, of course, they heat the ionosphere. And, of course, Jerry is trying to explain why they're doing this or why they say they're doing it. They spend countless millions of dollars. This is a secret government project. Why would they want to heat the ionosphere? Why would they spend all this money unless there was something to be gained from doing it? So pick up the story from there, Jerry.
Okay, the characterization of the ionosphere angle is such that we have all these satellites up now, and when the when there is solar max, when there's a lot of solar energy striking the Earth, this changes the dynamics of the upper atmosphere. It injects energy. The sun injects energy into the upper atmosphere, which changes a number of the properties of it, including making communications with satellites difficult. Also changing the way it bounces radio around the world. So they say that if they can isolate this and do tests on it and see what X amount of energy in a spot does, then they can better design satellites and systems to communicate with satellites. It sounds reasonably plausible.
Well, but is that the real reason? What do you think the real reason for it is?
It's a ground-based Star Wars weapon system.
All right, and I really think this is probably what it is. It's a ground-based Star Wars weapon system, but they can't admit that.
Right, because what it does is it injects this energy into not just the ionosphere, but above it into the magnetosphere, which is outer space. Which is, the Earth is surrounded, the Earth is a magnet surrounded by magnetic lines of force. And it creates these plasmas, these 2,000 degree clouds of bits of atoms moving at near the speed of light. and these clouds, these plasmas get trapped between the magnetic lines of force and are moving away from Alaska down these lines of force towards our enemies. So it is a way to create something like the EMP, the electromagnetic pulse that is associated with a nuclear blast. It's a way to create the EMP without having to actually set off a nuclear bomb. So by injecting this energy into the atmosphere, it gets trapped between the lines of force, and any incoming missile will get fried by it.
All right. So this then is a means of actually being utilized to an anti-missile defense. And you know, of course, if you look at things logically, why would our government lay itself completely open to a nuclear attack? Why would they have blocked any sort of an anti-missile defense all this time? Or maybe they really did have an anti-missile defense. They didn't want either the American people or our enemies to know that. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. The military doesn't want the enemy to know what they've got. And one way to prevent the enemy from knowing what they got is they don't tell our guys either. Remember, the way the American people found out about the stealth aircraft program was Jimmy Carter blurted it out at a press conference.
And of course, they kept the atom bomb totally secret up until the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. So they do not want the American people to know, of course, ostensibly. They don't want the enemy to know, but then maybe some people feel that the real enemy is not overseas, it's the American people. The elite really have all their sorts of secrets. They have other sorts of secret weapons. We can talk about those some other time. But I think this is really an amazing thing. It's called HAARP. And, of course, it is a... How much did they spend on that? Do you have any idea?
Roughly $200 million, which for the Department of Defense is pocket change.
All right.
And the appropriations year to year run a few million. I believe the current contract is $37 million to finish the job and have the entire field of antennas constructed and up to broadcast ready by the end of 2006.
But of course, they'll have them elsewhere in the world too, won't they? This won't be the only site.
Well, this is the only site for that program, but that technology can be used elsewhere.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Jerry Smith, and we're going to be talking about weather modification. We're going to be talking about chemtrails, which is really originated with an idea by Edward Teller to create a film over the sky to reflect the sun's heat. But does it really work, or does it actually trap the heat here on Earth and actually create global warming? Or maybe this, as Jerry has said, is simply a cover story to confuse the American people, but there are government reports that talk about the aerial spraying. Isn't it interesting that Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, Dan Rather, and Tom Brokaw never tell us about that? Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, of course, is Jerry Smith, and we're talking about the chemtrails. Now, are there any hazards to the American people from this aerial spraying? Of course, we know that, in some places they use aluminum and barium, and other places, actually, one of our listeners who's done a lot of research on this, Inga, I think is her name, she's talked about titanium. They're actually spraying titanium. Why would they spray something like titanium, a very fine titanium dust? Have you ever run into that?
Yes. One of the leading researchers is Clifford Carnicom, and Clifford Carnicom has an immense site with thousands of pages of stuff, and he has lists of he has actually done the lab work. He's actually collected samples and had the samples run through labs and have attempted to analyze what's in them. And there are some very strange things that he's found, including human red blood cells.
Now, why would you be spraying human red blood cells unless you were trying to create some sort of an abnormal allergic response on people or sensitize them? Or what's the rationale for that? Does anybody have any idea?
Well, I believe what I've read into seems to be transgenetics or biochemical warfare. There's a lot of speculation as to what these things are. Since it's a guessing game, and when you have a guessing game, there's usually one right answer and a whole lot of wrong answers. And so what chemtrails are is that we see in the sky something that doesn't seem right. And in trying to research this thing, we have found that there are some very tantalizing bits of facts and a whole lot of opinion. And so I have tried to sort this out. As I said, I'm working on a book on the subject. And at my website, jerryesmith.com, if your listeners click on books and then click on ongoing research, that will give them links to about 50 of the top articles that I've found that clear this up and answer these questions and give the technicals behind these things. There are a couple of researchers out there who have really done some great work, like Amy Worthington or Dr. Mike Castle. It is having guessed my way through this thing, I'm now convinced that there are literally dozens of different programs running that each one individually may not be a problem, but collectively.
Hold that thought for just a minute, Jerry. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we're talking about chemtrails, we're talking about the HARP, we're talking about really what's going on, and Jerry is saying that they're not one project, but a number of projects. Each one may not, of course, make much in the way of sense, but collectively, what are all these chemtrails really about?
Well, I can tell you what the apparent downside would be, that if the lab work is correct, if what we're seeing is indeed happening, if the patents that we can find are actually being used, that we are creating, we are changing the electrical conductivity of the soil. Now, by changing the electrical conductivity of the soil, normal God-made plants are not doing as well. However, the genetically modified transgenics are being designed to live in more electrified soil and are doing very well. And this, again, is where I said follow the money. Who's making money off of this thing? This is a way for Monsanto and the other transgenics people to wipe out regular heritage foods and replace them with their Franken foods.
And of course, anybody who controls the food controls the society.
Exactly. You know, and there is unfortunately a belief among the ruling elite, among the liberal intelligentsia, that there are just too damn many humans on this planet. Jacques Cousteau said 350,000 people have to be eliminated a day in order to meet the UN's target of 3 billion people on this planet.
Where did he say that?
In a UNESCO publication in 1991.
UNESCO Courier, November 1991. Any of our listeners who want to challenge what Jerry is saying, you just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll provide it in both English or French, if you prefer. What Jerry is saying is absolutely true. Jacques Cousteau said, we have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. Now, could you imagine if George Bush said that, or if John Kerry said that, why, you'd hear that every day. Jacques Cousteau could say that. Only the elite would understand there is a genocidal program throughout the world today that most people have never heard of because, of course, Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh paid fabulous sums of money not to reveal but to conceal the truth. from the American people. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to talk to our special guest this evening, Jerry E. Smith, who's done a tremendous amount of research on this and certainly is one of the world's leading experts on this field, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Jerry, is this a massive experiment? Is this a massive genocidal experiment? Are there really people who would do something this horrible, this crass, this indifferent, this uncaring, this truly evil to eliminate people from across the face of this earth?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in simple terms, yes. And again, there are lots of people on this planet. Many of them are evil, and many of them have very different agendas. And so it just happens that there is a confluence, if you will, between those who have agendas and those who have technologies. And some of the agendas, the technologies can be benign. Some of the things that HAARP is intended to do could alleviate global warming, could improve world communications. On the other hand, the crap they're dumping into the atmosphere could leave us all brain dead or simply dead.
Why would they want to use titanium, a dust of titanium? Is this more reflective? Does this have toxic effects? I've never heard of anything of that sort.
Well, I don't know about titanium specifically. That is to say, I do remember reading it in my research, but that was probably read that 4 or 5 months ago, and it's hard for me to retain little bits of specific things like that off the cuff here. I do know that there's a number of metals being used, and a number of chemicals being used, and a number of biological agents being used. Early on in cloud seeding, Israeli scientists were hot to use the E. coli bacteria because of its ability to bond with water, which would increase cloud seeding.
All right, so that they would actually be spraying some sort of a bacterial solution up there?
Exactly. You know, we have a situation where one of the major subjects that I deal with in my book, HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon, The Conspiracy, is I keep asking the question, is there some fundamental flaw in how we fund and conduct science? Because we have science being done by and for the highest bidder. Whoever can write the checks gets the science. And who writes the checks? I mean, who has the money? The government? But the government is just a machine. It's just a tool. Somebody runs the government. And who runs the government? The ruling elite. And what do the ruling elite want to accomplish? They want to make more money, they want to stay in power, and they want to get rid of the excess useless eaters.
And I think that is one of the hardest things for people to accept. First of all, that there's a ruling elite, and yet if you go back and read Bertrand Russell's book, The Impact of Science on Society, written in 1953, he talks about the elite and the fact that they would want to eliminate large numbers of people. Well, certainly Jerry has already talked about that. I believe it is part of the genocidal program that's taking place today. As you see cancer increasing, as you see new diseases coming along, as you see an AIDS epidemic, and oh shucks, we just can't figure out how to stop that. We can stop every other disease, but we can't stop this one. Do any of the things bother you at all? We see so many women having hysterectomies, a much simpler procedure would certainly do the trick. We find men losing their sexual prowess, and we can get into that and the effect of fluoride on the testosterone level in men, but, of course, you're never going to see that discussed in America. Well, let's go to Jim, who's calling us from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dr. Stan.
How you doing?
Good. Greetings to your guest. I wanted to ask a question in regard to another possible scenario as to why they may be spraying in the sky. And, you know, this has to do with the issue of the decline of the Earth's magnetic field and, you know, the increasing levels of ultraviolet light that are coming through and other, you know, damaging cosmic rays that are coming through. And I was wondering if quite possibly the reason they're spraying and the reason that they're not talking about it is because they're experimenting with ways perhaps to obstruct the flow of ultraviolet light.
All right, what are your thoughts on that, Jim?
Well, that is that's a hand in glove with Teller's concept of a basically putting a parasol over the Earth. It's within the realm of possibility, but again, I look at follow the money. Who's making money on this? What I can see right now is that the oil companies and the electrical companies are making buckets of money, billions of dollars, by having cold winters and hot summers. The global warming works for the multinationals. Another thing the multinationals are doing is the Frankenfoods. And if you can wipe out heritage crops, you have, one, the immediate benefit of you sell your genetically modified, and two, you also have the ability to turn off food to those people you don't want to be useless eaters anymore. All right.
I think, Jim, the truth of the matter is we don't know. We can have a lot of ideas, and we know some of what they say, but is anything they say true? Certainly the message that the military was putting out to the people in the military is they're using this to vaccinate us, to protect us from some horrible disease. I don't believe that for one minute.
No. The problem with aerosol spraying is if you want to spray your crops to kill a bug on your plants. Have you ever washed a crop duster plane? The plane is right down on the deck.
Right.
It's spraying the crops.
Right.
When you inject aerosols into the upper atmosphere, they stay up there for a very long time.
Right.
We have seen right here in Reno, Nevada, where I live, we had a couple of summers ago, we had whiteout conditions for a week because of a sandstorm in Mongolia picked up enough Mongolian desert dirt from the Gobi Desert to drop it on Reno because things stay in the air for so long once they get so high. Right now, the coral reefs in the Caribbean Sea are dying off because of a mite that lives in the desert dirt of the Sahara. And the Sahara dirt is being blown into the Caribbean almost 1,000 miles away. Once things reach a certain height in the a certain altitude, they stay there. You know, when Mount St. Helens erupted, the ash circumnavigated the globe three times. When Chernobyl blew up, the fallout circumnavigated the globe, I think, five times. So when you're looking at what's going on up there, really high up there cannot be specifically directed at a down here target. Now there are some exceptions to that, which I'd like to get into, in that Nikola Tesla had worked out what he called his big eye for surveillance, and it's one of the things I'm working on in this new book, and I'm still trying to get my wits around this technology, but apparently at the lower atmosphere, by injecting energy into it, you can create artificial auroras. You can create plasmas in the atmosphere, which can be used for a number of things, including surveillance. There is this company with a really strange name of Time Domain, and Time Domain has patented the through-wall radar technology, which is the heart of Tempest. And I believe that they have figured out a way to bounce this off of these aerial plasmas so that they can target a building or a person for Tempest-style through-wall radar eavesdropping.
Amazing technology. Anything else you want to ask, Jim?
That's all. Thanks a lot,
Thanks
guys.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Let's go to Jeannie, who's calling in from La Selva Beach. Hi, Jeannie.
Good evening. I wanted to ask Jerry, about a year ago, I was traveling down the center of San Joaquin Valley in California, and this is where we grow most of our food. And I looked up in the sky, and then I saw these parallel spraying in the high sky, but there was such a massive part of the sky was like rainbow colors.
Mm.
I want to ask Jerry, what creates these rainbow colors?
The rainbows have actually been around for quite a while. They were first noticed by sailors at sea back 30, 40 years ago, and they're called oil bows by the sailors, who believe that they are partially burned hydrocarbons in the atmosphere. What we're looking at, what you're looking at, is literally a rainbow. It is the diffraction of sunlight as though it's through a prism, and you're looking through billions of tiny prisms of ice crystals, and the ice crystals are acting like prisms and breaking the light down so that you get the rainbow effect. This is a very odd rainbow, because it is being colored or discolored or in part created by the things that are in the clouds.
Is it in a bull form, or is it merely just simply the clouds have the various colors? There's a rainbow, of course. You see the rainbow,
right.
The arc of the rainbow. But this
right.
is not an arc, I assume, Junie?
I see these all the time. If you have polarized glasses, if you have polarized sunglasses, they're very apparent. You can, and anybody who wears polarized sunglasses can look at a cloud and see these things, and some days they're more visible than others.
Yeah, well, they're not in a bowl. Like, I was just in Hawaii, where you have beautiful arched rainbows. But this covered a massive part of the sky, and it was straight across.
Right.
So I've never seen that before. So I was just curious if there's an oily substance in the
That's
air.
Really what Jerry was
yeah.
describing for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else, Jeannie?
That's it.
All right, thank you. Well, there are lots of strange things out there. And I think the first thing that, most important thing, is to convince people that these are real, that the government has this program. It's described, and of course you can go to Jerry's website, jerryesmith.com or .org?
.com, jerryesmith.com. I have two major sections I have three major sections in the website that would be of interest to your readers. One is I have a newsletter. I have 55 issues of the newsletter that are archived on the site, and I have a lot of chemtrail articles in back issues of the newsletter. I also have a links library. I have links to more than 1,500 of the most important websites on the internet. And my links library is broken up into 12 pages around specific subjects. And so one page is about HAARP, and the HAARP page has links to about 15 of the main websites that deal with chemtrails, like Clifford Connercombs. And then I have my ongoing research page, which is, I have a section called books, which is about the books I've written and am in the process of writing. And so if you click on books and then click on ongoing research, you'll find what I am currently researching and what I have found. And that has about 50 of the best articles on chemtrails and on about 100 articles on HAARP. So anybody who wants to follow up on what's currently going on with HAARP can go to jerryesmith.com, click on books, click on ongoing research, and get all the most up-to-date skinning on HAARP.
Okay, well, I think it's really so vitally important that people get interested. And, of course, this is a subject that you can talk to people on. They're going to scoff at you initially. And then when you can show them the reference to the government reports, to the patents that are out there, to the books that are written talking about how they are going to, of course, create this aerial spraying. And whether you believe, it's, as they say, you know, that they're to help, they're trying to stop global warming, or whether you believe it's something else, which I do. Why I think that it's important that now we can verify from government's own records that they actually have these programs certainly for aerial spraying. And then the question comes up, is there another agenda? Is there a definite program to mislead the American people? Well, right now we've got Tim on the line from Indianapolis. Tim, just hang on for a moment. We'll be right with you, and then we'll wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Tim, did you have a quick question for our guest? We're just about out of time.
Well, I wanted to comment on the West Nile virus. Here in Indiana, last summer, every other day, we heard on the 6 o'clock news about birds being found infected with West Nile virus. I thought birds migrated from north to south.
They do, but of course there's something very strange about this whole thing, Tim, because it didn't exist in the United States until 1999, and immediately when it came here, the CIA said, we think Saddam Hussein did it. Mm-hmm. Now, why would they bring up something like that? Well, I'll tell you what, I think that the first cases started in the New York area, which is not too far from Plum Island, right across from Lyme, Connecticut, where the first cases of Lyme came from. And on Plum Island, they have a lab called 257. We actually have a book on it. And they were doing a lot of experimenting. Do you have any thoughts at all on this, Jerry?
You pretty much covered it. As best I can tell, West Nile virus is a live, open-air test of how to do us and how we respond to being done. The government has done open-air tests on biologicals since the 1950s, and I think West Nile is just another one in a long, nasty chain.
If you think that sounds incredible, I think my newsletter, I believe it's July, August of last year, May, June, July, August, somewhere in there, we have an extensive background on all the new diseases they've created to do us in with. Anything else, Tim?
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. And, of course, Jim's point, birds go north to south. They don't go east to west. So why is this spreading across the country? Well, I think it was planned that way. I hate to say that, but there really are evil and wicked people out there. Jerry, we're about out of time. What are your parting thoughts with our listeners tonight?
Fight the future. We need to be active. The stuff in the air and our water makes us inactive. We need to get off of Prozac and off of fluoride and maybe even get some breathing apparatuses. But we need to become active in any way, about anything. I mean, just pick something and get active about it, because there's an awful lot of fronts that we're being attacked on.
We're being attacked on every side, as I think it was General Chesty Puller said to his officers when the communists had come across the Yellow River and attacked his 1st Marine Division up there on the Chosin Reservoir. We can shoot in any direction and hit them. We've got them right where we want them. They were completely surrounded. And that's where we are today. Jerry, thank you so much. I hope you'll be a guest on some of our other programs.
My pleasure. I hope to be back.
Good night. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, some people are going to say, why, this is crazy talk. These things couldn't be going on. Why, there couldn't be a government program of aerial spraying that would be, even be possibly harmful to
us. Our government
wouldn't harm us, would it? And I would suggest to you, if you believe that, you need to get the Rockefeller Committee report. It's available through Radio Liberty. It's rather inexpensive. You can get it. It came out of the Veterans Commission committee hearings back in 1994 over the name of Senator Jay Rockefeller. That's why we call it the Rockefeller Report. But it was really a Veterans Administration report. And if you want to know about the background of the experiments that have been done on the American people, if you'd like to know about the Gulf War illness, or why 40% of the wives of sick Gulf War veterans, why 40% of the wives are ill, you need to get this report and read it. You need to begin to understand that we're dealing with organized evil on a scale never before, and it is going to affect everybody in the listening audience. And then we have a four-tape set on chemtrails. We have a four-tape set on water fluoridation. We have a four-tape set on mercury. We have a four-tape set on aspartame. And, of course, we have a book on excitotoxin, the taste it kills, and the fact that the excitotoxin, the aspartame, the NutraSweet, is designed to create brain tumors. They know it produces convulsions. They know it produces damage to the brain so that we have an epidemic of obesity. They know all of these things. They just don't want you to know it. So, and then, of course, why do we have so much cancer today? And that's one of the questions we ask on our four-tape set. Why do we have so much cancer? Or is there really a war on cancer, I think is the title of it. Is there really a war on drugs? We have, of course, a wonderful four-tape set. If you've never heard it, it's called The New Order of the Barbarians. And it is based upon an interview with Dr. Dennegan, who in 1969 heard Dr. Richard Day, who was had been the medical director of Planned Parenthood, and I think he was at the time, telling the true story of the elite that rule the world. And it is the most incredible set of interviews you've ever heard. It's called The New Order of the Barbarians. And it comes, of course, you have to get it separate, but it comes with a complete transcript of what was said. There are three interviews by Randy Engel and one interview that I did. A vitally important subject of which we suggest you get, you listen to, and then you help us to disseminate. That's The New Order of the Barbarians. And, of course, these interviews were done by Randy Engel. Three of them were. One is my own interview because I wanted to make sure that I was convinced that this was a true story before I put it out. And I think it is. In fact, just 3 months after Dr. Dennegan heard this story, Dr. MacArthur went before the House Appropriations Committee, and we'll be glad to send you the documentation on this, the House Appropriations Committee for Military Preparedness, and asked for $10 million to create a new disease for which there'd be no immune response, and another disease, of course, that would simply incapacitate people. And then, of course, he said, well, of course, there's some people who say we didn't do this, because it's a new form of mass killing, but we want $10 million so we can create this disease. And 6 years later, we saw the first cases of AIDS, and shortly after that, we saw the new disease, entirely new disease, called chronic fatigue syndrome with fibromyalgia, another variant of this. Could it be that there would be something this possible? Well, you need, of course, to get our information. You will be glad to send you free of charge that government testimony by Dr. MacArthur before the House Appropriations Committee. We hope you'll want to get the videos we've talked about. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You want to get the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll because there really are satanic forces at work in our society today. And you'll actually hear the people talking about how they sold their souls to the devil. So that's the give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow, at the same time, may the Lord be with you.